right, welcome back to Earwax. I am Cody, joined by Hillary.
Hello.
What up? Just a few minutes, we're going to be talking about Rilo Kiley's The Execution of All Things. But first, we have our very first guest on Earwax. So excited about this. This is the lead singer and songwriter for Touche Amore, and also the host of the first ever podcast, Jeremy Bohm.
Hey.
Hey,
it's an honor to be doing this.
So cool. Appreciate you coming on. We were talking yesterday. This album kind of lands in a blind spot for both of us. So whenever you suggested it, we got really excited. If you don't mind kind of speaking to like why you find this album important and like why it made your list.
Yeah. I love that the sophomore record was the one that brought me in, kind of a thing. I think that's kind of a nice thing to remember or to think about with certain bands that, like, I think if you're a musician, it's hard not to think, like, man, if people don't connect with our first record, we probably won't have much of a career or something like that. But then if you make a really strong sophomore record and maybe, you know, it's a better production situation or a different label, whatever it is, like all of these sorts of things can really make such a difference. And I just think that's like a cool aspect of it, to where I remember being very aware of that first record, but it not at the time connecting with me very much. I had a lot of friends who really liked it, and I kind of was a little like, oh, that band's not for me. And then I'm such a big Saddle Creek fan. When Saddle Creek had announced that they were doing this record, I was like, okay, I'll give it a shot. And opening track, immediately I was like, okay, I'm a fan now. I'm in. So yeah, I think that's kind of like a cool side story with it, to where it's like it brought me in as a fan, and the fact that it was the second record.
People worry about the sophomore slump sometimes with a second record, and it's really nice to see a band who can evolve their sound and even connect with a larger audience, connect with more people, especially through such vulnerability that we see on this record.
Absolutely. I think you nailed it with the concern of the sophomore slump. And I think I'm a little wistful of the days of something being a part of a record label having that big of an impact, where I don't know if that really exists these days, where I think for a lot of people, record labels might just be like the different web store that they order the record from, as opposed to like the legacy that labels used to once have. And I don't mean to be reductive towards record labels, obviously, but like it was just different 20 years ago.
It's easier for people to find music through singles now, or like just connecting with the artist, rather than, it's less accessible, the information about the label. People are less inclined to go dig for that information, but there's like a whole community of people within it. It's a really interesting way to find new music.
Totally, 1000%. So yeah, the Saddle Creek of it all got me just instantly like, well, I'm gonna check this out for sure now. Nice. You know,
that's a great point, the identity of a label, like when you think about like Sony, Universal, like the big ones, that it feels like a homogenous kind of
1000%. Yeah.
Because they do so much, but something like Saddle Creek has a very particular identity. And I don't know if that something that we're kind of seeing go away with the advent of the internet and how accessible everything is, kind of like what you were saying.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, there's also a situation where I think a lot of labels that maybe were tried and true for having a specific sound, or you know, just a respectability, I guess, has maybe gone away for the sake of like hoping to just sell records, you know, where like maybe they put out stuff, some labels, they used to put out one thing, now kind of put out another thing. Which is totally fine, but but yeah, this was at such a specific era for this music, for that scene, for Nebraska, you know. And it was cool that this was like the Nebraska label taking in an LA band, you know, and kind of making it fit their mold in a way that didn't feel
inauthentic.
It was completely an authentic way to do it, and it even gets name dropped on the record.
In the record, yes.
Which is cute. So yeah, I think all of those things kind of really excited me about this record, and then I just became obsessed with it. You know,
one thing I wanted to ask is, like, this album is kind of them. If the first record kind of got their foot in the door, this one kind of pushed them, and they're here, right?
Yeah.
Is there a moment that you can reflect on in Touche Amore where it feels like this is not normalized, but like this is my life? Like,
yeah, it was. I mean, it was genuinely our sophomore record too, where the first one that we made. Not to get like so deep into the history, but like we didn't think anyone outside of our friend group would ever hear it. Mm-hmm. So like we recorded it with a close friend, and our band was almost like kind of going to break up because we had lost our original drummer. And we were like, man, let's just we're proud of these songs. Let's just record it anyway. Yeah. And then halfway through that process, we're like, we could just get another drummer. So that's what we did. And then we had played a festival, the Sound and Fury Festival here in uh-huh. California. One of the co-owners of the label, Death Wish Inc., saw our set and approached us right after and was like, hey, we should know each other. And so our follow-up record, kind of similarly, in a completely different sonic realm, Death Wish being such a household name and like owned by one of the singer of Converge, like this whole thing, like there's a respectability and like people will check that out because it's on Death Wish. It's yeah. like, you know, people will trust whatever they're putting out. So us getting to put out our sophomore record on not only that label, but like my favorite label in mm-hmm. that world, just got us out to such a wider audience. And, you know, we got to record with somebody that we were excited about. We went to Kansas to record, you know. So it's like it was like this whole experience that we never thought we would really have. We got to hit a wider audience. And then that record I'm sure there's people today that still think that that's our first record, even though we had this one before it, you know, because that was the one that people heard first.
Right.
Where in Kansas? I'm from rural Kansas.
Oh.
Where at in Kansas?
Eudora.
I know the name. That is out in, that's nowheres.
Yeah, so it's...
With
it's,
all due respect.
No, no, Eudora. No, truly, truly. It had one main street that had a post office, the recording studio, and a Mexican/Chinese restaurant.
All right.
And like that was...
All your food in one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like that was Eudora. It's like just outside of Lawrence.
Oh, Lawrence is a great city.
Lawrence is amazing. And like the above the studio was an apartment, but we went there because the guy who owns it and it's like the Get Up Kids and Coalesce and Casket Lottery. Yeah. A lot of these bands all these Kansas or Kansas City based bands all recorded their records there. So we love the sound of some of those records. So we're like, well, let's go to that place and do it. Yes.
Shout out Eudora, Kansas.
Eudora, Kansas. Yeah. Like there's a Get Up Kids compilation, like B-sides collection record that's called Eudora, like based off of, because that's where most of those recordings I think took place.
There's something special about recording in a place where it doesn't feel like there's a lot more going on. I feel like, especially as we're about to talk about Saddle Creek, they were sort of the only place in Omaha that was making music like on a large scale. Mm-hmm. And it seems like very interesting to have just a group of people with one dream, like something they're really inspired by, just get together and make it happen so young, you know, and for everybody to flock to them and find this one place, you know, there's something very special about finding that environment in a place that feels like there's nothing else around it quite like it.
And something that I think is so sweet about so many of the bands from that scene and from that label. My band was lucky enough to play some shows with Desaparecidos, which is a Saddle Creek band. Connor Oberst, it was like his punk band. Befriended some of those guys. And on a trip to Nebraska one time, I got like a coffee with the drummer of Desaparecidos. I think it was the drummer. No, I forget what member it was. But anyway, he was telling me, he's like, oh yeah, like, so-and-so from this band owns that bar. So-and-so from this band owns that ice cream shop. So-and-so from this band owns that record store. So it's like they all put the money back into the community.
No, that's so cool.
So like they all easily could have just, you know, moved to Brooklyn, moved to LA, yeah. and then just like started their career, kept their careers going there. But I thought it was so cool that they invested back into their own town. It was also really amazing to be such a fan of like Cursive and or Tim Kasher in general, and drive around Nebraska and just laugh at like how he just named everything after like the tagline of Nebraska's The Good Life, which is one of his bands.
Right.
There's Saddle Creek Road, which is the name of the label, and then there's Happy Hollow Road, which is a cursive record. So I'm just like, you all just drive around and just go, eh, that.
I like that.
Yeah, yes,
that,
yes. Yes.
That's, we'll use that. I'm out of ideas. We'll use that.
Totally. Yeah.
All right, we got some pretty cool in-store events coming up. Sunday, April 2nd at 2 p.m. at our San Francisco location, Avant Prague metal band Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum are doing an in-store performance and signing for the new album, Of the Last Human Being. That will be interesting, I'm sure.
Very interesting, absolutely. And today, which is Thursday, March 28th at 5 p.m. at the Hollywood store, Empress Of will be doing an in-store performance and signing for the new album, For Your Consideration.
Wednesday, April 3rd at 5 p.m., Low Moon will be doing an in-store performance and signing for the new album, I Wish You Way More Than Luck.
And on Thursday, April 4th at 5 p.m., Sierra Farrell will be doing an in-store performance and signing for her new album, Trail of Flowers.
It's going to be sick. I'm going to be there.
We're really looking forward to it. And you can always find more information about all of our in-store events at amoeba.com.
Booyah.
Well, I don't know if you guys know this, but we are getting a brand new Sheryl Crow album. It is titled Evolution, and you'll be able to pick it up on CD and color vinyl. Very mysterious. Los Angeles locals Chicano Batman are releasing their newest album, Notebook Fantasy, on CD and clear vinyl. Live, Laugh, Love is the new album by pop rock band Chastity Belt, their first in 5 years. You can grab this one on CD and cloudy color vinyl. Shoegaze Legends are releasing a brand new album under the name Interplay, which will be available on CD, vinyl, and blue vinyl. Folk duo The Secret Sisters have a new album called Mind, Man, Medicine coming out on CD, vinyl, and open jade vinyl. And last but not least, a shout out to electronic soul artist Serpent with Feet, whose most recent album, Grip, is getting its physical release in the form of CD, vinyl, and clear vinyl.
Awesome. Great
whole bunch
lineup.
Of stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
Bunch of different
opaque
stuff.
Jade vinyl is a...
That's right.
That's just jade.
I'm going to name my first child that.
Yeah, it is just jade. You didn't need to emphasize that,
opaque,
I guess.
Opaque actually means the opposite color, right?
No. Nope, that's translucent.
Thanks, Spencer. All right, this week's album of the week is Rilo Kiley's The Execution of All Things. It was released October 1st, 2002. It was their second studio album, and it was produced by Mike Mogus. Very quick history of the band. Jenny Lewis and Blake Senek are child actors who turned to music. They're both California natives, which is extremely apparent in their sound. Their first EP was financed by Dave Foley, who was an early fan. They followed that up with Takeoffs and Landings, which is their first album released in 2001. That kind of got folks' ears perked up. They pick up Pierre de Reeder on bass guitar, and fully transparent, I don't know how to pronounce this last name, Jason Bozell on drums. And this is the lineup that is kind of locked in moving forward. While touring on the first album, they met Tim Kasher of Cursive and The Good Life, and Kasher invited the band to join their caravan on the cross-country tour. This would have big implications on the direction of The Execution of All Things. Along the way, Kasher gave them a tour of Presto Studios in Lincoln, Nebraska. This studio was founded by Mike and AJ Mogus. Mike also founded Saddle Creek Records, which we have mentioned and we'll talk about here in just a second, with Justin Oberst, and Rilo Kiley signed on with them shortly after. And I've seen a couple different bits of the band talking about the creative freedom that they felt that signing with a label and going into a studio would afford them. That's something that I wanted to ask you, Jeremy. What is the kind of process or the difference between like writing songs in your own home and the comfort of your own home versus like stepping into a studio for the first time?
Yeah. I mean, I have to imagine. So, you know, I'm in a situation where we're a band that has a lockout that, you know, we'll just get together when someone's got a riff, and then kind of. I don't think we've actually never written a song. I don't think we've ever written a song in the studio. But in the studio, songs can take different forms and things like that. But yeah, it's. I would be curious to know how much of this record was actually. Does it say the record was like fully written in Nebraska? Does it?
Go ahead.
Oh no, please.
They have talked about definitely going to and from the studio, and it being like snowy and like the treachery of going. But I didn't see anything about how much of the songs were written in the studio.
Yeah. I always do love though when there's like lore about a band's record or something like that, where they're like, they say they're very influenced by their surroundings and all of those sorts of things. As we've talked about with Saddle Creek, like you can hear that energy specifically on this record, you know, more so than the record that followed or the record that was previous. There's that like, you know, Laurel Canyon energy, I think, in everything Jenny Lewis does.
For sure.
But it's got that sort of middle of the country twang to it at the same time. So I think it works in a very specific way. But yeah, I don't know that I can really answer on the difference between those two different writing situations. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think that I like the mention of the energy, because this would have been recorded in like March-ish of 2002. And March in Lincoln, Nebraska can be
frigid.
Grim.
Yeah.
Grim.
Yeah.
And that is definitely like the Laurel Canyon, the mix of that energy, I think really is a nice kind of balancing act that they're able to pull off.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk a little bit about each individual member so we give them a little time. And while there's not a ton of information available on the drummer, we know quite a bit about the other three members. We have Jenny Lewis, Blake Sennett, Pierre de Reeder, and Jenny Lewis, we know very well as a solo artist now. Her work is very popular. She's worked with many other very influential artists. And she serves both as the lead vocalist, keyboardist for this album. She plays some guitar on this album as well. And then Blake is a lead guitarist. And we have Pierre on bass. But each of the members will sort of move their instruments around as they see fit for each song and how, like, where their talents lie for each song. Also, with this record, we see a shift from Jenny Lewis being one of the lead singers to the main lead singer. Yeah. There are two songs in this album that feature Blake as the lead singer, but she's primarily taking the lead.
Right.
Jenny Lewis talks a lot about her influences. We have people like Built to Spill and Neil Young. She listened to a lot of Patsy Cline, Lou Reed, The Cure, The Pixies, which are like really all over the place for me. I can hear bits and pieces of them in the inspiration that she draws for her lyrics. And personally, I feel like that is really where her talent lies. She is an incredible lyricist. She's super vulnerable.
Absolutely. Something that I wanted to point out, this feels like a good time. And this isn't to talk about my own bullshit, but we're currently in like a final stages of getting ready to start recording a new record. And I'm the lyricist in the band, and something that I admire is when a songwriter, a singer, the first word of a song is really important. Mm-hmm. And it's so easy to fall into just doing a lot of eyes, you know, like you know, whatever. And I get really excited when a singer uses words that are not as easy to start a song with. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the opening word to every one of these songs, there's not an I to be found. It's a lot of like, you know, the paint's peeling, like all like more. Yeah, there's sometimes there's some ins, things like that, that every time I'm trying to find something like a good starting point, this is a good record for me to sort of think about the opening lines of a lot of these songs and have that be an influence where it's like, wow, you can just like pull from something totally sideways. And I think that that is a great example of someone who's a great lyricist.
That it's really interesting that you bring that up, because when we were first talking about this record in conjunction with having you on as a guest, we were talking a lot about how interesting that was, like the music that you make and the music that Rilo Kiley makes. They're not exactly similar in genre.
Yeah.
But lyrically, I definitely see a resemblance. Yeah. I see
vulnerability for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's very clear there. And I love how Jenny Lewis specifically through her lyrics in Rilo Kiley, like what you were saying, it's less starting off with like a very simple sentence than it is introducing you into a scene that is already happening. You know, yes. She has this very clear vision of what is going on in the song, both metaphorically and actually. And she's just letting you in as it's already happening.
Yeah. Yeah. Anytime you read or hear a song, you know, read the lyrics or hear a song, that it can make you say, wow, I wonder how uncomfortable this was for so-and-so to hear it. I think that means you've accomplished something great.
Totally.
Yeah. Like, I mean, better son or daughter.
Oh,
like
man.
That one's up there. You know?
It's songs like that that I feel like, right, that's where Rilo Kiley's power really is. It's in this feeling of, I'm gonna just lay myself bare as much as I can on stage and just hope that other people will connect with it, because it's so rare that you see that people aren't brave enough to do it often.
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole other can of worms right there, where, you know, I feel like we're unfortunately in this era where people are afraid to be quote unquote cringe.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
and like totally. Share too much and overshare and things like that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's always refreshing to listen to this record and be like, there it is. Like, that is what it is. And also, you find, and I've certainly found, that the more specific and detailed you get about a situation, the more people will relate. And as you're writing it, you feel like no one's going to relate to this.
Yes.
Because it's so specific to my situation. Mm-hmm. But then you realize, like, no one's really that unique.
Totally.
You know?
Totally. Like, this is so embarrassing. I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
But only, especially like through a community like music, it's such an easy way to go, oh, we both like the same band. That also means we probably have a lot of other things in common. Like, we are also very open about our emotions.
Right.
Or we also, you know, have like a similar moral or political belief, maybe.
Right.
It's a good way to find a community through that.
Yeah. I mean, we just got home from an Australian tour the other day, and we have a song called Palm Dreams, which I say like going 65 on the 5 at 5, mm-hmm. which is obviously like a very impossible thing in California. You know, it's like, it's supposed to, like, it's to frame the idea of like something that's impossible. Mm-hmm. And the amount of people that know that, like, sing back those words in there, and I'm like, this is like Sydney, Australia. You have no idea what this is, but
unless you did a ton of research,
right? Yeah. And it's just one of these things, though, where but I've met people along the way that, like, they have their own connection to like what that could
interpretation
mean or whatever.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's just the first thing that popped in my mind, but. Cool. Yeah.
With Rilo Kiley's case, it certainly helps that their vulnerability and like all of that kind of dense songwriting in the best way is juxtaposed with like pop hooks.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's such an infectious sounding record that you can't not hear it, right? Some of those guitar licks are just like, that's just going to live in my head for the next 3 hours.
Right. And the sound of the record too, because in a weird way, it feels pretty lo-fi, mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. Though the songwriting is not, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of the big leads and things like that, like, there's big rockin' parts on this record, yeah. but it still feels pretty mellow in a weird way. Mm-hmm. And but it's complementary to what I think they're trying to achieve, you know?
Well, that's the kind of marriage between the LA and the Omaha yeah. sound, which I wanted to touch on because, like, Omaha was the hotbed of indie rock at this mm-hmm. time. I would have been like 11 or 12 years old when this record came out. I was nowhere near cool enough to be in on, like, I just, it was not on yeah. my radar. Was the Omaha scene and like Saddle Creek, were you locked into that from like ground floor? Like,
great question. I started working at a record store in Burbank, California, the Saturday after I graduated high school. I chose that instead of college. Yeah. And so that was 2001. Mm-hmm. And I worked there for like 5 years or something. So I had bought Fevers and Mirrors from Bright Eyes, the same, fuck, I used to have this off the top of my head, what the other album I bought at that same, in that same purchase. But I remember liking the other record a little bit more at the time. Like, because the opening track on Fevers and Mirrors is, it's very antisocial and it's a very like, you have to work to get into this opening track. But once you get to track two, the record expands and becomes very what it is. But I didn't immediately love it. And they were playing at the El Rey that following weekend, and I didn't go because I was like, oh, I'll catch them next time. And then I became so fucking obsessed with that band and that album that I kicked myself forever. And if I this could be lore that I've created in my head, but I think the tour was Bright Eyes doing Fevers and Mirrors, The Faint doing Dance Macabre, and Cursive Domestica. So like those three bands were on the same show, I think, together. And the fact that I missed that, I like kicked myself forever. But through Bright Eyes, a friend had turned me on to Cursive's Sink or Swim. That EP is perfect. And so that was my like, okay, there's something going on here. These people know each other. They're playing on each other's records. So then, and also people started requesting it at the record store. So I started stalking all of the Saddle Creek stuff. So by 2002, 2003, it was like, this is clearly a thing,
yeah.
you know? And everybody, like, even the lesser known bands on Saddle Creek would still get a purchase now and again, you know, bands like Sun Ambulance mm-hmm. or bands like Lullaby for the Working Class or like any of the, you know, sort of next tier down stuff. People would still just check out because there's a hope that maybe Connor sings on this. Maybe, mm-hmm. you know, so-and-so sings on this.
Because they're so collaborative yes. in that label. You know, everybody is helping out everybody. And it's funny that you mentioned that because I think that is the album that Rilo Kiley also mentioned they picked up. And that is of Bright Eyes. They picked up that album and then like very soon after Saddle Creek asked them if they wanted to be a part of the label and they were like, yeah, we just picked up this album. I mean, it's really good. So
yeah. That's so funny.
And that's that kind of like that sense of collaboration. Whenever you have a good thing going, like if you're kind of in Omaha, this is the hot thing. It would be easy to kind of reject the LA influence, but they were willing to like, this band has something to offer that we maybe don't or that we see in them. I think that's really smart on the labels side of things to identify talent and be like, let's kind of expand our identity and our yeah. sound by bringing in a group like Rilo Kiley.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I think that there might be one or two bands on Saddle Creek from that time that maybe weren't, if they weren't Nebraska, they were like, a state away. You mm-hmm. know what I'm saying? Like maybe they were an yeah. Iowa band or something like that. But yeah, it's bold to take some of us coastal elites, you know? you know? It's pretty cool. It's, you know what's so funny is I don't think I realized that Presto Studios was in Lincoln. I think I had always assumed they were always Omaha.
Yeah, yeah, I saw that too. That's interesting. It's in Lincoln. To that point, Jenny Lewis had said that the studio put them in a perpetual state of longing and that the performances were born out of a drunken freezing experience, which
gotta stay warm, I guess.
Yeah, I was gonna say that sounds like it could just be like a Wednesday night in the Midwest,
right?
Like,
sure,
you know, like a longing, perpetual drunken experience. Come on,
right.
Friday in That's Kansas, just,
yeah, that's funny.
What was that? Oh, you mentioned the El Rey. I have a great story about the El Rey that is tied to this album.
Great.
This, the record release show was supposed to take place at the El Rey.
Yeah, this excellent.
And they had to quickly move because the El Rey was damaged and in need of severe repair because Faith Hill was shooting a video or a special of some kind, and somebody in her crew tried to hang a car from the trusses, and the trusses on the ceiling of the El Rey broke.
Collapsed, yeah.
And so they had to shut the El Rey down for however long. Rilo Kiley quickly pivoted to some random warehouse, but that did not happen because of insurance purposes, because
sure.
It was a random warehouse.
Yeah.
And they eventually had their album release party right next door to where Amoeba is now at the Fonda.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Was the Fonda yet?
They said it was the Henry Fonda Theater. Yeah. So I'm not sure.
Must have been small. It looks like they reached out to basically everybody. Venue in Los Angeles that they could find, and everywhere was booked. And the Fonda was like a last resort, which is hilarious because it's like such a hot spot now.
Yeah, sure. In my memory, it's like I don't remember really going to shows at the Fonda until maybe a few years later. So that's interesting.
Funny.
I love that. Just,
yeah.
Who's going to? A car? Like, yeah, no, that'll fit there, on the El Rey.
I was very on the edge of my seat with that story because I'm like, who would have got the venue shut down? Did fucking Gwar play there? And then you're like, and you say Faith Hill.
I'm
like, what did Faith Hill do? And then it's like, hung a car from the seat.
When I think Faith Hill, I think explosions. I think special effects.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, full budget.
Did Gwar play?
Pyro.
Yeah. Gwar and Faith Hill, definitely known for their antics.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought that was so great. When I was just like furiously writing it down whenever I saw that. I was like, this is the greatest story I've ever heard.
So funny. That is so funny.
It's so great. So we've talked about like the vulnerability in the songwriting. One thing that I kind of wanted to touch on before we really get into like the track list is to me, there's a theatricality to this record that is, obviously they have a background in acting and television. I believe that Blake Senna and Jenny Lewis had either ended their romantic relationship or were in the process of ending their romantic relationship as this record was being recorded. That's obviously there within the songs. And then every so often, the theatricality aspect of it, I think, comes through most clearly with the snippet of the song that is tagged on through
like the interludes.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's such a smart way of like kind of showcasing how all these things that they're talking about are affected by your past, and they're affected at different moments in your life. And they're, because one of the snippets comes on at a song that Blake sings, So Long. And so like her, we'll say baggage, it's not really the most nice word,
but yeah,
like her, that not only affects her, but it comes out and it affects someone else and her loved ones too.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant, brilliant way of conducting a through line.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. It, you know, ties the whole record together in a very specific way that feels like an experience as opposed to just a record, you know? Like there's the more you listen to it, the more you get from it, you know?
It is, just to like clear it up for anybody who hasn't listened to the record, there is like a secret 13th track, you might call it, called And That's How I Chose, and That's How I Choose to Remember It. And scattered throughout three of the songs on the album, the song will end and then a part of this song will begin. And you get to hear it woven throughout the tracks of three different tracks of this record. And for me, that was very, when I was just listening to this, it caught me off guard a couple times before I actually realized what was happening. I was like, dang, didn't I just listen to this? like a couple times. Or I think there was a moment where I was like, this song sounds really similar to like a different song before I understood what was going on. And then I was able to piece it together like a puzzle. And that in itself is really, you were saying theatrical, yeah. Like, absolutely. There's this idea, especially for something so personal. She's talking about her parents' divorce and how that affected her. And especially in contrast to whatever song came before it, it really feels like this is her moment to pull you back in and remind you that this is the person who's singing to you. And like, this is where she's coming from.
Yeah. Well said.
Yeah.
So the opening track is The Good That Won't Come Out. I think that it's super interesting to have a pop song that is using climate change as a metaphor in 2002. Mm-hmm. It feels like such an ever-present topic now. It's everywhere. You can't escape it. But 20 years ago, it doesn't feel like it would have been as common.
Right.
And I think that there's a highlight for me of her songwriting here, where she's talking candidly about mental health, saying that, like, you say I choose sadness that has never once chosen me. Maybe you're right. That's a profound statement. Ouch. To be beautiful. Making.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's like, I feel like that's one of the most, like, fucking
powerful
script tattooed 2003 things possible.
Totally.
You know what I'm saying?
Totally.
But yeah, I mean, I think that, or, you know, someone's fucking MySpace quote or something.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's a good, I mean, it's a strong quote. I you know, the way it's sort of highlighted in that song by having this, you know, big performance of it. She knew what she had with that line. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to also point out with that opening track, something that drew me in really quickly. I don't know if it was on purpose. I don't know if it was an influence. I don't know if it's just circumstance. It happened to happen. But I don't know if you're Death Cab for Cutie fans at all. But their album, We Have the Facts, that's my favorite Death Cab record. Mm-hmm. And this opening track does the same thing that opening track does, which is the first half feels very quiet and sort of lo-fi, and you don't real. And then it has the big. Then it all comes together and has this, then it gets much louder. I love that about the song title track off of We Have the Facts, and the fact that they did the same thing, like, was like, okay, you knew the move and you performed the move well.
Yes.
You know, like, because there's, you know, they didn't come out too far apart from one another. I do wonder if that was an influence with Rilo Kiley's choice.
It's all of the good that won't come out of them, and all the stupid lies they hide behind. It's such.
How far into the first, because you said that this album immediately clicked with you. How far into the first track until you were like, well, this is the best thing? Like,
it was when it came in loud. It was like you did the Death Cab move and you did it well. You know, like, you did it right.
You did it right.
Yeah, exactly.
It's also a good way for them to showcase their fluidity through, like, different genres.
Yeah.
Like, showcasing, like, this is really the lighter side of the music that we do, and just kind of hitting you hard with the harder part of it.
Totally.
Yeah. The next song that I have is So Long.
I want to talk a little bit about Paint's Peeling, mostly
it.
Just because I... Like, similarly to what you said with the title track, I love how this song opens up at the end. And I think that metaphorically, this song, like, the lyrics of this song connect with me a little bit more than some of the other songs on the album, because I felt like, just even with the title of the song, Paint's Peeling, there is automatically a feeling that comes with that. And you're sort of put in this place of discomfort before you even really know what it's about.
Yeah.
Great song.
So Long, the thing that I wrote down was, so the bands are fans of Elliot Smith.
Easily. Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't have a frame of reference for Rilo Kiley, aside from Jenny Lewis's solo stuff before this. When I heard this song, I was like, I bet these guys worked with or toured with Elliot Smith. It's just such a, you can hear the influence, and they did. They definitely opened for him a bunch. It's one of the two tracks that Blake Sennett sings on. It's you can hear the stylistic shift. He's a different songwriter. He's just as vulnerable, but it's a interesting, like they had two pretty big songs and then this one kind of comes inwards.
Right.
And it's great pacing.
Yeah. Should we mention Salute Your Shorts?
Yeah, I know. We totally breezed over their connection to child acting.
Yeah, I just want to throw, like,
yeah,
you know, she's a few years older than me. I think she might be like 5 or 6 years older than me or something. But as a kid, I mean, the movie The Wizard
yes,
like she was like she was one of my first like little kid crushes when I was hilarious. I was just like, I like girls into video games, like what, like yes, this is so she was a huge crush. And then I loved Silly Your Shorts as a kid.
Okay.
Like loved it, like Silly Your Shorts and Hey Dude and all those shows that were like made for kids my age. So Blake Sennett was like this figure in my life. He also was in Boy Meets World,
yes,
which was a show that is near and dear to me as well. So then when you get older, then you're like, wait, now they're in a band together, these people. That was the thing.
I can't believe we didn't even talk about this. First of all, Spencer is a huge Boy Meets World fan.
Oh yeah.
So when I told him about Blake, we were just dying. It was very funny. Just a funny coincidence. Like both of them. She also, Jenny Lewis, grew up like in so many things. Like you said, one of them was Life with Lucy, where she played a Lucille Ball's granddaughter.
I've never seen that.
I read this interview where she was talking about how crazy it was being a child on set with Lucille Ball, and like she would just be chain smoking and like yelling at people. God. She said she would tape her face back like a cheap facelift all the time.
Oh my God.
Just hilarious.
Wow. That's wild.
I also read this thing where like one of her last acting gigs when she was much older was in this movie called Dawn's Plum.
Right.
Have you ever heard of this movie?
I think I only know it from looking at her IMDb. Okay. But I'm familiar with Foxfire, though, which was another movie that she did.
I'm not familiar with it. But Dawn's Plum, I went in this like whole rabbit hole around it because it's very interesting because she was an actress in it. Blake wrote all the music for it.
Oh.
Leonardo DiCaprio was like one of the main stars in it, as was
Tobey Maguire,
yes. And the movie itself got banned because both of those lead actors were told that it was going to be a short film. And then the director edited it into a full-length feature film without their consent. So Leonardo DiCaprio sued him. And now there's like an entire, like, how many years later? 20, 25 years later, there's like a website, Free Dawn's Plum, where the director is like sending out his movie for free. Like, just email me, I'll send you a copy of Dawn's Plum, etc. It's so interesting.
Oh, yeah, that is really interesting. Jenny Lewis was just on this podcast, 24 Question Party People, and she talks, and it's just funny to hear her talk about, like, she's like, oh yeah, Leo, blah blah blah. It's just like, you're just casually friends, yeah, Leo. It's like, cool. I'm glad that they stayed friends through that whole ordeal.
Absolutely. You know? It's so nice. Strange.
Yeah.
Free Dawn's Plum.
It was also like Tobey Maguire and Leonardo DiCaprio worked together later on The Great Gatsby.
Yeah, right.
And I had no idea they had this like early introduction.
It goes deep, I guess. Yeah. I like Blake as a songwriter. Mm-hmm. I really do. I will say that my favorite material from him is in the band that he did after this called The Elected. Like, they have a record specifically called Sun, Sun, Sun that I think is just absolutely extraordinary. Mm-hmm. His songs in Rilo Kiley, they always felt, they didn't take me out of the record, but maybe they were a little jarring because you get so used to one thing that when the gear shifts. I don't know that I ever connected as much with it, maybe because I felt like it shifted a little too out of the way.
Sure. Almost feels like a different band.
Yeah, exactly. And when it comes to like how you're talking about this sort of through line of the storytelling and stuff like that, you have to wonder if behind the scenes, if that was ever much of an issue, you know, mm-hmm. kind of a thing. But it seemed like their relationship had a bit of that.
Definitely.
So when all of a sudden he had this other band, because they have three or four records now, but I remember being like, oh, cool, he has a band. Maybe I'll check it out. And then I did. And I was just like, oh, my God, this is like perfection for what he was trying to do. So if listeners haven't checked out his band, The Elected, certainly check out. His first two records are really, really good. But the Sun, Sun, Sun record, which is the sophomore record, it's excellent.
In interviews, like a couple times between the two of them, Blake and Jenny, I would see him compliment her on her songwriting and her compliment him on like his production. But there seemed to be like some tension in between that a little bit where he was like, you know, he wanted a little more of the lead vocal part and she insisted like, that's what I do in this band, you know, which is good. It's better for it, you know, but it is funny, like seeing them do their own solo work. It seems like they really tapped into that wheelhouse.
Right, right. There's a song, and you know, I don't want to assume, but there's a song on the Sun, Sun, Sun record, which there's no way it's not about Jenny Lewis. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like the opening line is like, "You get real mean when you're drunk," and there's a line where it says, "You say my songs suck." Like things like that.
Definitely. You can feel that when they're talking about each other.
Not subtle.
Not subtle, yeah.
Or they'll have little comments where they're like, yeah, we argue, but we love each other like a family, you know?
Yeah. You have to wonder if that's what's holding them back from playing shows.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, also, all due respect to her solo career, which is fantastic.
Yes.
Like,
for sure.
I can totally understand not. But also, just did the Postal Service stuff. she just did that. So, you know, while on this album cycle for her new record. So, we'll see.
True,
we'd all love
true.
To see it, but also I respect their solo careers.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Execution of All Things was the only single that was released from the album. You mentioned this earlier, the reference to Omaha.
Mm-hmm.
I like when bands are kind of winkingly transparent in their songs. It's like a nice little fourth wall break.
Totally.
And I didn't catch it the first time that I listened to the record because I hadn't looked into it. And then I was like, oh, I see what you did there.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
I like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's just perfect. It hit me right here.
Right.
Like, yes, thank you. Do more of that.
That song also features Greta Cohen on cello, and she was a part of Cursive. But since then, she started working in the podcast industry.
She's the CEO of Pushkin.
Yeah, I know, which is the audio book and podcast service that was co-founded by Malcolm Gladwell.
Wow.
Yeah. There you go. And that happened like this year, I think earlier this year.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Big shift. Career shift.
Yeah. Playing cello on a Rilo Kiley song to the CEO of Pushkin Industries. There you go.
Glow up.
Yeah. A Better Son and Daughter is my favorite song on the record. I don't think that's any surprise.
So good.
It is an absolute banger of a track. Everything feels anthemic.
Mm-hmm.
It's cranked up to 10. You have the Anne Hathaway.
Oh, yeah. We read this thing about Anne Hathaway where she talked about how this song is so meaningful to her. And she told the story about how she really prides herself about being a person who gets to work and just like gets the job done, you know, like doesn't let anything outside influence how well her work is presented. And she just had like a really bad day at work and everybody was being really supportive, but she was feeling terrible and she was really down on herself and was in sort of a dark place. And then I think that she put her iPod on shuffle the next morning on her way back to work. And this song came on, A Better Son, Daughter. And she found herself connecting to the lyrics, especially the beginning where she talks about, you know, like sometimes I wake up in bed and I'm just like frozen, you know, which I feel like is a feeling that everybody can relate to, you know.
Yeah.
I can't find the motivation to get out of bed this morning. It feels harder than just staying here, you know, so why bother? And she really felt herself in that moment. And then when she showed up to set, everybody knew that she had had a bad day before. So they all came to the car to greet her. She like threw the door open and blasted the song as loud as she could. And like everybody started dancing together in the parking lot and stuff. She said it like changed her life, that moment and this song.
Wow.
Yeah.
Probably not what Jenny Lewis had envisioned.
Agreed.
You know? Yeah.
That whole, like, and sometimes you're on and you just really fucking
yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
And sometimes when you're on, you're really
can't not get charged up about it.
Yeah. The proper, a proper fuck word.
Yes.
In a genre that you don't expect. Great.
It's so
great
good. Stuff.
She hits it just perfectly.
Yep.
And people talk about how it's so fucking beautiful at the end of this album is like the big fuck in there. Yeah. But I really like this one more than it like hits you. Sometimes when you're on, you're really fucking on. Like, I just feel like when I'm doing my best, I'm the greatest. But when the lows hit, it makes the highs feel fucking cheap.
I'm with you. Right? I'm absolutely with you. I was listening to Spectacular Views as I was pulling up, which has that one. And what I thought in my head when listening to it was the fucks in this song seem like the first take and the only take.
Mm-hmm.
The fucks in that one, that seems like
planned.
Let me hit it again.
Yeah, yes, it again. Absolutely. Oh,
like,
agree.
Like, yeah, that one was good, but it's so fucking beautiful. Yes. Like it has like a performative aspect to that line delivery, where the line deliveries in this one feel
just like, I just need to let it out.
Yeah.
She has talked about this being the song that people repeatedly come up to her and be like, this is the song that like,
of course.
And then like relaying some pretty like personal stuff. Like this is what, you know, this helped me get through that. As someone who has written some stuff that's pretty intense, does that always put you on your heels, or do you find a way to kind of navigate it?
Oh man, that's a thing. I don't think that I've ever been fully prepared for when it happens. It's happened, you know, and I should preface it by saying, like, anytime anyone has ever connected with anything, I'm as flattered as you could possibly be, especially if it's like helped anyone in any capacity, like as flattered as can be. But as the person who wrote the song, you obviously it's a wound that never quite ever closes. You know what I'm saying? So when I'm hit with it unexpectedly by someone wanting to talk to me about it, it can be tough. You know, some. My response often is to obviously say thank you, and I'm glad that I was able to help in any capacity or whatever. You can find comfort in it. But then I usually start asking them questions about, oh, so are you from, you know, like I try to change the subject as quick as possible. And I think that's just, for me, some sort of like trauma response to get out of it.
Yeah, it's such a marked difference when a crowd is singing your song.
Totally.
And then like a one-on-one. That's pretty intimate.
Yeah. And there's been so many times where, like, you know, my band knows I'm like jealous of them because like they'll all come out after a show. You know, I have to, you know, I'm not someone who necessarily like hides in a backstage room. Like we'll go watch one of the openers, like, or another band we're on tour with from the audience, just because I like to hear it that way. Or whatever, if I'm just like walking around before the show. And I'll see someone talking to my guitar player or drummer or something like that, and it's just very like, they're talking about what they recommend to eat in town, or like some very casual conversation. And then I'll walk by, and then they'll turn to me and be like, hey, what's up? Hey, listen, my dad died when I was, and I'm just like, oh, I thought I was going to have, I thought this was going to be easy.
You're going to tell
and
me then, about the Chinese-Mexican place.
Exactly, so, you know, and again, I can never fault anybody because I understand, I've been there too. Sure. I've been a fan, you know, there's been songs that have helped me or I've connected to in so many different ways. And then if I have the opportunity to see that person, I understand the instinct of wanting to say thank you, you know, but sometimes it goes deeper than that. And sometimes it goes longer than that. And, you know, it's a tricky thing. Our last record, there's a couple songs that like I wrote specifically about that situation, about just kind of being like, whoa, like I didn't know that I wasn't preparing. Like when writing, because we have a record called Stage 4, which is like entirely about my mom's passing. And then there's a song on Lament called I'll Be Your Host, which is like very much about that, where it's sort of like, I wasn't signing myself up to be the spokesperson for like dead parents.
Yes.
But I, in our little scene, kind of felt like I became that. But what's been really wonderful is like in these last few years, I feel like there's a lot of bands that have now opened up about their similar experiences. And there's this band Fiddlehead that they've put out now a few records about the singer's Pat and his father passing, and like that being such an influence on him. So he and I have now bonded about that experience where it's just like, oh, like what's your life been like since putting out those records? And like, how can we bond over this together and have this shared sort of situation that we're both in?
It's got to feel like a little bit of relief too, that you're not the only one that is
right.
Of,
Yeah. And also, I mean, like, I also want to give credit where credit's due. There's this band Pianos Become the Teeth. Like, they put out a record before our record that is very, very, very much very candid and very open about his father passing and things like that. So, like, you know, I'm not trying to say I'm the only person who's gone through it, but I certainly feel like for when our record came out and, like, the way it's been brought in, like, I understand the... what Jenny Lewis is talking about with that song being the thing that kind of knocks her back sometimes having to talk about it all the time.
Yeah, and like, I mean, this record is now 21 years old. That would be tough 20 years down the road, and you probably processed and moved on from that, and people still finding your music. I'd never listened to this record before.
Right.
And like coming up 20 years later being like, I love this song. I like this.
Yeah, let me talk to you. Like, I'm sure for her being like, "Hey, yeah, my mom and I didn't have the greatest relationship ever. Let me tell you about my mom's situation." You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's but great song. I just love the. It feels like all of the production on this song, like not that this is the last song on the record, but it feels like all roads to this, all roads on this album kind of lead back to this song.
Totally.
It's so swelling. Brilliant track.
Yes. Yeah. 100%.
Yeah.
Is there any other track that you have that you'd like to touch on?
I feel like that With Arms Outstretched song is worth mentioning
for
like the big campfire sing along of it
all.
You know what I'm saying?
With the clapping at the end.
Yeah. Like for a song that, it's a great on the road song. Like, you know, you sort of get that feeling from it, but then it feels like the community that they're now a part of embracing them this specific song. Where it, like,
with your arms outstretched to me, now it's 16 miles to the promise.
Sort of envision all of these Saddle Creek bands in the room with them doing the clap along and the sing along and sort of that sort of thing. Even if you're creating that situation in your head, it does feel that way where, you know, this feels like a community effort with the song.
I feel like I think Connor Oberst is on that. Like, he's providing back, like, I think a lot of those Saddle Creek, the crew there are like, they're on the campfire sing along.
Yeah.
And that's a great point. It feels like, we're just a big community. And we're doing it.
Yeah, and you're welcomed in.
I love finding super important records that overlap with my personal timeline, but that I missed. They're like a window into a past that I didn't know I lived through. Listening to this album was such a joyful mix of nostalgia and discovery. The Execution of All Things is a remarkably thoughtful album, touching on big topics with a vulnerable frankness that never feels affected or forced. Do you have anything that you would like to say to just kind of sum up your thoughts on this album?
I just think that it's, you know, sort of what we touched on in the very beginning of this. Like, I love the idea of a band breaking on not their first record. Yeah. I love the mix of sound that they were able to accomplish, as we've talked about with like the West Coast versus middle of the country sort of energy. I just think it's incredible songwriting that feels very timeless. Like, this record, as we talked about, is like 20 plus years old at this point, but this kind of still feels like a record that could have come out this week and would get all of the, you know, Pitchfork love and all of the love that would come that way, you know, from it. And I think if you're able to accomplish that and not have a record sound dated in any capacity, you know, like this, it doesn't sound like they're trying to achieve a specific sound that was necessarily popular, even though it was a sound that was popular at that time with all of the Saddle Creek stuff. But like, I think a lot of that Saddle Creek stuff hasn't really aged poorly because it does come from such a genuine place of their roots and like their identities and things like that. It's a beautiful record that I've never been tired of.
Yeah.
You know, like it's something that, when I'm just in my living room and I want to hear something that is sort of a comfort zone, this is one of those records, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, man. We always say whether you've heard it before, or never heard it at all, throw on this album.
Please do.
Thank you all so much for listening. Jeremy, thank you for coming on and being our first guest. Where can we find you at things?
let's see. If we want to do the old Instagram, my Instagram is Jeremy X Bohm. The band is Touche Amore, and it's just Touche Amore on Instagram. Twitter, X, whatever you call it, is a garbage fire. Let's not go there. Yeah, Instagram feels pretty good still, sort of. Yeah.
Ish. Yeah. It feels fine.
Yeah. I have a podcast, which is the first ever podcast. You can find that on Instagram, or you can just type that into wherever you stream stuff. And you can find that there.
This is a great name for a podcast.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
If you guys have any questions or comments, album suggestions, please email us at earwaxpodcast@amoeba-music.com. Amoeba, each of the locations has a Facebook and Instagram at Amoeba Berkeley, at Amoeba SF, and at Amoeba Hollywood. Amoeba Hollywood also has a TikTok page at Amoeba Hollywood. You can find us on Instagram and TikTok at earwaxpod.
Also, you can sign up for our email list for contest coupons and updates on what's going on in all three store locations. While you're there, check out our website for free shipping on music and movies within the U.S. And also check out our web series, What's in My Bag? The latest band we've had on is the industrial noise rock band Health. Some of their picks include Faith No More, John Coltrane, Soft Moon, Natural Born Killers. It's all over the place. A lot of good picks. So make sure to check that out. And also please make sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you guys all so much. And we will see you around the store.